Welcome to Strong Tower Radio Today. The views and opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect the views of Strong Tower Radio, West Central Michigan Media Ministries, or its employees.
Welcome to Strong Tower Radio's Good Growing with the Garden Eye with Gary Heilig and Tom Azure. Gary, we're on location this time.
Yes, we are. I'm quite comfortable.
Okay. That's the easiest chair I've ever seen. You got a upholstered chair, and you're ready for questions from the audience.
I just need something for the legs.
All right. Sweet, sweet, sweet. Well, we're going to be talking about avocados. We're going to talk about flowers that we cut in early July and many, many other questions. Plus, we have a studio audience. We have, we have 25 people here, and that means we're going to have many, many questions.
You know, Tom, I've never had to look up to you when we're doing this.
I feel so honored. Look, Gary, would you lead us in a word
sure.
of prayer?
Our Heavenly Father, we thank you for this day. We thank you for gardening and for the opportunity to see your wonderful miracles as we put seeds in the ground and harvest fruits from the trees and the vegetables. We pray that as we learn these lessons, that we'll develop a character that will fit us for heaven. We look forward to the day when we're gardening in heaven, which will be totally different from what it is here on earth.
Amen.
And we ask that you'd come soon so that we could enjoy all the blessings that you have planned for us. In Jesus' name we pray, amen.
Now, we have a live studio audience here, and we're doing this quiz. Usually I rely on my sister Sue to help me out, but I have almost 25 people to help me out, and I'm going to use all the lifelines I can get. So
I try not to make it hard.
Okay, so if any of you have an answer, shout it out nice and loud. I'll repeat it for our audience what you think is the answer, okay? And Jesus, you're on my side. Jesus is Gary's wife.
Ready?
Yes, I'm ready.
Okay, number one. Avocados originated in what region? A, Southeast Asia, B, Western Africa, C, Mediterranean Europe, or D, Mexico and Central America?
Western Africa.
Do we have any other answers here? Western Africa.
Is that your final answer?
It is.
Jesus is here.
She's
Mexico.
Yeah, it's Mexico and Central America.
Mexico and Central America. Yeah. Hooray
keep,
for
keep
for
that in mind.
Okay.
Okay, number two. What country is the world's largest producer of avocados? Is it Peru, Colombia, Kenya, or Mexico?
I hear Mexico, I hear Colombia. She's going to say Mexico.
And Mexico
and
would be right.
Kenya.
Mexico.
Mexico is right again.
All right. Now, this
cartel,
one.
Cartel? Isn't there an avocado cartel in Mexico?
The cartels have been trying to take over production. That's a whole different story, though.
All right.
Number three.
Which
avocado variety accounts for most global avocado exports? These are variety names like Red Delicious Apple or whatever. Is it bacon? Fuerte, Reed, or Haas?
You better repeat that again. They said Haas. That is almost unanimous. It's Haas.
Is that yours too?
I go with them.
Okay,
I go
correct.
With the majority.
Haas is correct. What is distinctive about Haas avocados when they ripen? Is it A, they turn bright yellow, they become red, their skin darkens from green to purplish black, or their skin becomes smooth and shiny?
C.
C.
Oh, that was a gimme, wasn't it? Anybody that eats avocados would know that one. Okay, number five. What nutrient are avocados especially known for? Vitamin B12, vitamin D, potassium, or iodine?
Potassium.
Now, I'm going to give you a hint here. No vegetable contains vitamin B12.
She said potassium.
Hey, what do you say, Tom?
I go with the majority.
It's potassium, that's right. As a matter of fact, if you have kidney issues, you don't want to eat a bunch of avocados.
Okay.
Number six. Approximately how much of the fat in avocados is considered heart-healthy monounsaturated fats? Is it 10%, 30%, 50%, or most of the fat content?
Most of the fat content.
Yeah, that was kind of, you know, if you learn how to take tests, you can figure that one out. Okay, number seven.
I like this audience. I think I'm going to bring them on every week's program.
Yeah, I notice you're not answering until they finish.
I am a host.
Number seven. Which country is one of the highest per capita consumers of avocados? A, China. B, Russia. C, Mexico. D, Egypt. You better not get this wrong, Sal.
Mexico.
Definitely Mexico.
But you know, it's usually China.
Yeah, they do consume and produce a lot, but not avocados.
Okay.
When was the last time you saw Chinese food with avocados in it?
That's true. I never.
The U.S., though, doesn't Mexico send like most of the avocados here?
No, it was about who is one of the country that has the highest per capita consuming. So the Mexicans eat more avocados than even Americans.
It's an all Mexico food, somebody
pretty much,
said.
Yeah.
And what's also interesting is when I was a child, we didn't have avocados in these parts very often.
Okay, now this one is going to be...
There you go.
This one is a little more difficult. Number eight. Avocado flowers have an unusual characteristic. And that characteristic is self-pollination syndrome, reverse flowering, type A or type B flowers, and double blooming.
Okay, audience, I'm counting on you.
I'm going to guess type A and type B.
Oh, why did you guess that? No, it's right.
Type A and B.
Like if you have a Haas, you have to have something like a bacon. One produces the A flower, which means it opens in the morning.
Okay.
And it releases the pollen then. And the other is just the opposite. It's the afternoon. And unless you have a plant with each of those types of flowers, you don't get avocados.
Really?
And the flowers are very small, so you wouldn't even notice what's going on.
It's A and
it's
B.
Having A and B type flowers.
It has a morning pollination and an afternoon pollination. Does it need both of them, or is it just needs
have,
it all day long?
You have
long?
To have both flowers, an A and a B, in order, because it's not only the pollen's ready, but also the female part of the flower, the pistil, is receptive to pollen.
Okay.
So it's kind of complicated. All right.
So how do they pollinate?
It's insect pollinated.
So how do they
And follow? Somehow the insects know what to do. Number nine, which U.S. state produces the majority of U.S. grown avocados? Is it Florida, Hawaii, Texas, or California?
California.
Oh, it's definitely California. And do you know what area used to produce the most?
Nope. San Fernando Valley.
It's around... San Diego. That's where most of them were found. I forgot the county name. Number 10, what percentage of an avocado's weight is typically water?
What percentage water?
10 to 20%? 30 to 40%?
30 to 40.
About 70 to 75%?
75.
Or more than 90?
More than 90. And the answer is...
Oh, yeah, this was a tough one, huh?
10%.
Well, we've got 10 and we've got a 20.
You want to go for a 50-50? 50-50 is more than 90%, about 70 to 75%.
Wow, it's on the high
Which one?
End.
Which one? Those are two different answers. You have to pick one of the two. There's avocado oil, but not juice. Okay, so you got to pick between 70 to 75% or more than 90%. 70 to 75%, that's right. Because you can't really squeeze water out of an avocado very easily.
It's not like an orange.
All right, which of the following is a lesser known avocado variety? Listen closely, Tom.
Oh.
Gala.
Gala.
Fuji.
Fuji.
Valencia.
Valencia.
Pinkerton.
So the first three sounded like apples, so and one to orange.
First two are apples.
Next one's
the third
orange.
One's an orange. So what is it? It's Pinkerton.
Thank you for the help.
Okay, number 12. Which statement about avocado trees is true? They are annual plants. They are members of the pine family. They grow only in deserts. Or they are evergreen trees that can live for decades. How many choose that
can you
one?
Clarify evergreen.
Not like evergreen. Well, evergreen simply means it doesn't drop its needles at the end of the season or its leaves.
That one.
Even evergreens drop needles, but they don't do it annually in the same way. They don't drop everything. Only drop some of them.
We'll take D.
Yeah, it's D. Mm-hmm. It's an evergreen
Thank
tree
you
that
for
can
your
live
help.
For many decades. Number 13. You only have three more to suffer through, Tom.
Oh boy.
Which avocado-producing country has become the world's largest exporter after Mexico? Is it Chile, Kenya, Peru, Spain?
Peru.
It's Peru. You're getting how to take the test, too. It's Peru.
Peru.
And if you read labels at the store, you pick up on that.
Peru's become a large agricultural exporter.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Which vitamin is particularly abundant in avocados and helps with blood clotting and bone health? It's, you want to hear all this?
They made up their decision.
Mm-hmm. All right, it's A, C, D, or K?
K.
Yeah, it's K.
Good job.
Very intelligent audience.
Yes.
Here's the last one. Approximately how long can a healthy avocado tree continue to produce fruit? 5 to 10 years, 10 to 20 years, 20 to 30 years, 50 years or more?
50 years or more.
Wow, that's pretty good. You must be the A student in the class.
I tell you.
Is that what you were going to say, Tom?
I had no clue.
Well, I would have guessed 50 years or more just because it's very different from the others.
Okay.
Because it said 5 to 10, 10 to 20, 20 to 30, 50 years or more. That kind of gives you a bit of a clue.
Okay.
You did pretty well. Audience did great. Yes.
What pests do avocados have?
I'm thinking, I have never really seen, probably the biggest pest I've seen is people squeezing them at the store, leaving bruises. As a horticulturist, that really bugs me because there are better ways of determining whether an avocado
is
ripe without squeezing it. Because at the top, there's a stem, a little nipple, you might call it. You take that off, if it's kind of yellowish inside, your avocado's ready. You're not squeezing it at all.
All right.
But getting back to the original question, I can't think of any pest. There are probably some varmints that will feed on them, but I've never seen any indication of any kind of insect damage on avocados. And even the best people checking things coming in, produce from other countries, there's usually something coming in once in a while, and I've never seen anything. So, but I tell you what, I'll write that down, and it'll be in next month's program.
There you go. Now, question, how far north?
Just write that down so it'll be in next month's program because I don't have a pen with me. I'm sorry.
So how far north? I've never grown an avocado, so tell.
Well, it's a subtropical to tropical plant. So southern Florida, way down deep, like in California, the southern part of California. But you can actually grow them in Michigan, but they have to be dwarf trees and they have to be in pots. And you either have to have a greenhouse or you bring it inside.
It sounds like the ideal thing. No pests. I mean, that's, and it lasts 50 years.
Well, certainly not going to have very many pests up here in Michigan.
Yeah.
So.
Well, wonderful. I really appreciate it.
Everything has pests. Remember, we live in a sinful world.
That's true.
When we lived in Africa, we had a tree in our backyard, and the avocados were so big that my mother weighed one, and it was 7 pounds, 5 ounces.
Wow.
Yeah, they're different rate, what they call races of avocados. And the ones that grow in Florida are, I think this Guatemalan race, they tend to get larger and they're more watery. But the ones, the Mexican race is like the Haas type, and they're more oily and more dense and they have more of a nutty flavor. Mm-hmm. But I think there's like 3 races of avocados.
Well, Gary, these guys are good. In fact, one I heard from the audience that they want to know when we're going on the road. So
hey, that's up to you, bub.
Okay. So we'll have to get some destinations. So put in your requests, and maybe we'll do this. Besides, once a year, we'll go on the road.
Yeah, I'm just retired to hanging out at home, so
all right.
Me and my dogs.
All right. And Jesusa.
Yeah, she's home sometimes. She's always gone somewhere.
Well, you're listening to Good Growing with the Garden Guy with Gary Heilig and your host, Tom Majeur. And we'll be back after this break, and we're going to talk about many, many more things.
This is Ruthie Calkins from Tustin. The Bible tells us that heaven will be the dwelling place of God's friends. That's why I'm so excited about supporting Strong Tower Radio, their unique blend of thought-provoking speakers, stirring inspirational messages, and heartwarming music reaches into the lives and hearts of each listener, helping them to develop and cherish a friendship with God. If this radio station has been a blessing to you and your family, why not join me and hundreds of others in supporting Strong Tower Radio with a financial gift? They're 100% listener supported and could really use your help right now. You can send your check to Strong Tower Radio, Post Office Box 567, Cadillac, Michigan 49601. Or you can visit their secure website to use your credit card at strongtowerradio.org. Strong Tower Radio, where God's character is proclaimed.
We're here as Good Growing with the Garden Guy. Gary, we're at Great Lakes Adventist Academy, east of Edmore. We're at the Michigan Camp Meeting, and we have a live audience, and they have been a lively audience. We've really appreciated it. They've already given us some questions, and so let's start out with questions, Gary. Okay. How do you eliminate vine borers? Tell people what a vine borer is.
Well, first of all, what vine are we talking about? Are we talking about squash vine borer? Well, it's interesting that you mention that, because usually squash vine borer starts to become a problem in July. And they start becoming a problem when the squash or whatever it is starts to vine out. So usually early July is when you want to start watching for them. It's a clear wing moth. And they generally like to lay their eggs at the base of the plant, but they can lay it anywhere on the stem of the plant. And the only way you can really keep them out is by putting on an insecticide so that when that egg hatches, they'll get the insecticide and it'll kill them. It just so happens they're in the order Lepidoptera, which is the order of butterflies and moths. So there's a product called BT, Zilocerian ginsis, that will kill them. Now, when you put BT on, and you can start in the June going into the beginning of July, realize that it's only going to be good for about 3 to 5 days, because it is a bacteria and the sun will break it down. But when the larva hatches out and they start trying to chew in, they'll get some of that bacteria in their gut, and it produces what's called an endotoxin, and they don't feel so good, they get sick and they die. Once they get into the plant, then you can't do anything about it.
Now, there's something on squash I've observed, that it's kind of a black bug, and it has kind of a black charcoal gray. Is that the same borer?
No, that's a bug that usually shows up toward the end of the season, and they will feed on things like pumpkin and
squash.
There's those holes in them. But most of the time, people harvest their stuff before they become a problem. It's usually the stuff that gets left in the field that becomes the stuff that's being eaten. Not usually worth spraying for.
One of the other questions is, has anybody eaten the fresh sprouts of hostas? Have you eaten hosta sprouts?
They are edible. I have not tried them. I have too many other things I can eat. And I grow hostas for, you know, the decorative reasons. But yeah, you can eat hostas when they're first starting to come up. So I have no idea what they taste like, though.
They say, like, I heard they taste like an asparagus.
Mm. And I saw someone made a real face when he said that, but I don't consider asparagus something with real strong flavor. I kind of think of it as like water chestnuts, for instance. If you have freshwater chestnuts, they're really good, but they don't have a very distinct flavor. So, but if you want to eat your hostas,
do it early. Well, give us a report on that, because we may start becoming connoisseurs of hosta sprouts.
It's something to remember when times get really rough.
Jesus is stepping up to the mic.
So where can we buy BT, and is it organic?
Bacillus thuringiensis is organic product because it is a bacteria. And you can buy it at any garden center. It's under the name Dipel Thuricide.
Impede. There's a number of different names.
Thank you. There's a question here, is how do you kill bindweed naturally? The internet says that it can go down to 30 feet, and if you leave just 1 inch of that root, it can re-sprout and start all over.
Now, are we talking about field bindweed? Because that's not a very big plant. I just want to be sure that we're...
Also pink and white flowers.
Yeah,
pink and white flowers.
If I remember correctly, it's in the morning glory family. Does it look like a little morning glory? Field bindweed is one of those things that is hard to get rid of. When we had it in the horticulture gardens on campus, we would treat it with Roundup. And most people don't like to use Roundup, but it does do the job. What we did, though, is we would take the field bindweed off of the plants, pile it up, and then just spritz it with the Roundup, and it would kill it. Now, when my wife was mentioning acetic acid, and I had that as something to talk about, it is a material that can be used as a burn-down product. You can buy.
What's the word burn-down mean?
Burn-down simply means it kills the top, but it doesn't kill the roots because it's not translocated down to the roots.
Okay.
And I was playing around with some of this. You normally buy about a 30% acetic acid solution. I got some at Home Depot, but then I found one in a cleaning area that was 50%. That stuff is dangerous. And so I sprayed it in an area on an evening when there was no wind. At least I thought there was no wind, because you always have these little micro winds around. And it just damaged my raspberries and didn't stay where I put it. But it did. The next day, everything looked like it had been sprayed with Roundup because it was dead right to the ground. So you can use those as a burn down. I wouldn't suggest 50% unless you're going to use a respirator, because it's an acid and it can do damage to your lungs if you're not careful. So 20 to 30% is sufficient. It won't get rid of it completely, but it will keep it under control. You'll have to retreat it every now and then. If you continue to do that, then eventually it will exhaust the sugars in the roots and it will die out. But it might take a while.
And I think I'm identifying with this in one of our previous houses about 10 plus years ago. We had a bindweed that was in the front garden area around our, we had bushes there, ornamental bushes. Can you treat bindweed with this acetic acid without damaging it?
It's a general burn down material, so it'll take anything out.
Okay.
So what I would suggest you do, if you have it growing away all over the place, cut the bindweed down at the ground and then pull dead stuff out as it dries up, and then start to retreat it as it grows back. And it's in a very small area, so it'll be easy to treat it with the burn down material without destroying everything else. What I would probably do to protect things around it would be to get a large can and cut the top and bottom out, put it over the area you want to spray, and then just spray down into the can, and it keeps stuff from drifting to non-target plants.
How much residual is it of, if you use acetic acid, how long would it continue?
Oh, it's not going to bother anything unless you were doing it year after year after year. It'll tend to drive your pH down.
Okay.
But just occasional sprays aren't going to make much of a difference. And even if it did change the pH somewhat, you can always use lime to bring it back up. But it would take a while to do that.
I have another question here from the same listener here in the audience. Is grass clippings okay mulch in a food garden?
It's okay as long as you have not used weed control materials on the lawn for the past 6 to 8 weeks. And the indicator plants that would tell you you shouldn't have done that are your tomatoes, because the tomatoes will start to have twisted leaves and they'll grow rather strangely when there's a weed control material on the grass clippings. Otherwise, if you haven't sprayed anything on the lawn, it's fine to use. I mean, it may not be the most attractive thing, but what you could do is put it down and then put some straw over that if you want something a little bit more attractive.
So weed and feed, you put that. What's the last you should put weed and feed down? And then how many weeks after that can you use the grass clippings for your vegetable garden?
6 to 8 weeks before you could use it.
Okay.
Otherwise, you'll have some pesticide damage. It may not kill the plants, but it'll sure make them look strange.
All right. A good question. Thank you for that. One is a fairly large topic, but one near and dear to your heart, rose care for bushes.
Well, with roses, we pass the primary bloom about mid-June. And depending on what kind of rosine you have, you can have repeat blooming during the course of the year. Sometimes you'll have, say, shrub roses that might bloom once, and then that's pretty much it for the year. Other types will continue to bloom a little bit. The first thing you want to consider is after the major bloom, you need to prune off the dead flowers. And if you look at a rose bush, the leaflets come in clumps of 5 and 7. You might have 3 up at the top, and then you'll get 5 and 7. You want to go back to the first leaflet group of 5 and cut at about a 45-degree angle just above the bud in the leaf axle. And then that'll cause that bud to grow, and it'll produce another flower, depending on what kind of rose you have. In terms of fertilization, the roses should be fertilized at least once a month and stop by August, because you don't want them growing too vigorously as you get into the colder weather. Of course, you want to keep the weeds under control, and also realize that when we get into July and August, you start having problems with rose chafers, rose slugs, and also Japanese beetles. So you need to watch for those. The rose slugs kind of feed on the upper surface of the leaf, and it looks like the leaf is almost clear because part of it's missing. So watch for those rose slugs. There are some systemics that they say you can use, but remember, if you use something like imidacloprid on roses, which would keep the rose slugs off, that chemical will get into the pollen and can cause problems for honeybees. So if you want to protect your honeybees, then I would not use a systemic material. Systemic fungicide is okay, but not insecticide.
In the systemic, can you define that?
Systemic means that when you spray it on the plant or put it on the ground as a liquid, it's picked up by the roots and goes throughout the plant.
Okay. Versus the burn down, which is on the top.
Well, burn down, we're talking about weed killers versus insecticides, which are used for killing insects.
Oh, good.
So what about neem oil?
Neem can be used in a wide variety of insect pests, and roses would be included. You can also use spinosad. Both of those are organic products that are general use. And neem, if you start using it early before, say, feeding of Japanese beetles, it does have a bit of a repellent ability. But once, say, Japanese beetles start feeding on something, then the neem will no longer repel them. But it will repel them on plants that haven't been damaged for about 24 to 48 hours. Not very long, but it's better than nothing.
It's been said that a picture is worth 1,000 words. And Gary, one of our audience here, shared a picture for you. And it looked like it was purslane.
Purslane, yeah.
Purslane.
Purslane is an annual weed. and it, which annual simply means that it goes through its life cycle from seed through vegetative growth to flowering and producing seed again, all in the same season. And purslane tends to have what I would call a medium death root. You usually don't see it more than about 6 inches long, and they're fairly easy to pull up, especially when they're young. When they're first growing, I just use an action hoe, and if you cut off the root, then the top will die out. And as we were talking about during the break, purslane is an edible weed, so remember that one too when you have to go out into the wilderness. It is not a bad idea to kind of bone up on what you can and can't eat, because when we're no longer able to buy or sell, those weeds are going to start to look pretty good. But it's not hard to kill. Purslane can be smothered out while it's just germinating by putting down a mulch, like a thick straw mulch, and it won't grow through it unless it's really well established.
What are weeds that we have in our yards that we could eat if we needed to?
You can eat dandelions. And you can also eat
the stem, the bloom, the leaves.
The dandelion, the leaves usually, but the root is edible too. Whether or not it's tasty or not, I don't know, but it is edible. Also, there's something called red root pigweed that you can eat. And we had a lady from Africa come over, and Jess and I were just pulling out these weeds. That's what it was, and her eyes went like this
here,
and she said, "What are you doing?" And she said, "We eat this stuff in Africa." I said, "Knock yourself out. We'll go get you some bags." And she was out there picking, and it was a good year for red root pigweed. She picked until her husband Ruth literally drug her out of our field. And also, Chenopodium or lamb quarter,
yes,
is edible. And you know, quite a few things that you can eat in the yard.
You know, wild.
It's a good idea to get a book on edible wild plants. Then, of course, you have wild raspberries and different things that grow around all the time.
You know, the wild grape and such, we had some guests, and they went out and picked those and made stuffed grape leaves out of it.
Yeah, you can eat not only grape leaves, but the wild grapes. We have wild strawberries that grow around. You probably heard of pokeweed, the term poke salad. Is basically young poke weeds. They do build up oxalates in them when they get older, so they're not the best thing to eat, especially if you have problems with kidney stones. But while they're young, you can eat them. And don't forget those hostas.
Well, one last question for this round is, how do we get rid of snow on the mountain?
Yeah, well, that was a little tough. Snow on the mountain is a perennial that usually has, there's a variegated version of it, green, white, and there's some that's just green, and it spreads. It kind of, yeah, it's nice, but it will move. And the only
way. Is it fairly invasive?
Pardon?
Fairly invasive.
Yeah, it would be considered invasive. And I'm assuming people only use Roundup. So what I would do is cut it down and mulch really heavily over it, and if it tries to come up again through that, cut it down again and just try to exhaust the sugars in the roots, and eventually you'd kill it out. You could dig out as much of it as you can and then just retreat with a burn down anything it regrows, but it's going to be a job. It's not an easy thing to get rid of.
I'm glad I've not had that experience, or I'd remember it, right?
Yeah, you would. But if you need a ground cover and you don't want to have to worry about it, no insect problems, no diseases to speak of, and you have a pretty good barrier to keep it from moving, like a cement sidewalk, it works fine.
Let's go on some of your prepared questions. Flowers that are ready to cut in July.
Well, before we talk about the actual flowers, once you cut a flower, because we live in the world we live in, what happens to them?
Starts dying.
They start dying right away. There are ways that you can slow that process down. And certain plants, you can use cytokinins, which are the little packets of materials that you can buy. But that's a plant hormone. but most of these will not respond well to those, and you have to use something that contains a sugar, an acidifier, and a biocide, which is designed to destroy bacteria. And you probably heard of Floralife and also Crysal, C-H-R-Y-S-A-L. These are materials that have those three materials in them, and it will help to extend the life of your cut flowers. And it's best to cut them early in the morning because the stems will be well hydrated. And if you have to recut them, do the recutting underwater. Make sure your containers are clean. And when you put water in it, you should change that water every 2 days or so, not much more than 2 days. And of course, use the material in it to slow down the degradation of the plants. And some of the plants that you can harvest in July, depending on how early you planted, are zinnias, and they can last up to 12 days if you take care of them in the base. Sunflowers, I've got a lot of sunflowers planted this year, and also cosmos, which is a nice filler plant. It's a very delicate plant. It's one of my wife's favorites. Snapdragons, there may be some snapdragons that are still blooming in July. Celosia or coxcomb, and there's two types. There's kind of like the fan type, but the one that most people like to use in mixtures of flowers is the plume type. And again, if you get them in late May, by July, you'll be able to harvest some of those. Black-eyed Susans, bee balm, yarrow, which also can become very invasive. Shasta daisies. I like the look of Shasta daisies, but they smell terrible. It's not what you want to put in a fragrant collection bouquet or flowers. Has anybody ever stuck their nose up next to a Shasta daisy? What does it remind you of? Kind of reminded me of vomit. That's not something I want. That's phlox. We've had phlox blooming already. Hydrangeas can be harvested, of course, roses. And then there are certain plants that you use as fillers, like foliage, like Dusty Miller, which is, it has a little yellow flower, but people grow it for the little, it looks like a snow-frosted, silvery-colored plant. Mint, of course, you can use it if you wanted a fragrant Russian sage. So there are lots of different things that are available for July for cut flowers.
You mentioned about in the preservation, you cut it underwater.
The idea is to not get bubbles in the xylem. The xylem and phloem are like your arteries and your veins. And the xylem carries water and nutrients up to all parts of the plant. And the phloem primarily carries material, the sugars that are made in the leaves, to all various parts of the plant. So it's more downward flowing and sending sugars to the roots and that type of thing. So when you're cutting something underwater, you're not getting bubbles in the xylem layer, which will cause water to move more easily through that little series of tubes.
Very good. We're going to take a break right now. It's Good Growing with the Garden Guy here at Great Lakes Adventist Academy at the Michigan Camp Meeting. This is our second annual Q&A program. So stay tuned. We'll be right back after this break.
Green trees and green grass gives us freely and cheerfully life-sustaining oxygen. Your green backs, when put to work for the Lord at Strong Tower Radio, can result in life-sustaining salvation to the lost, the effects of which can literally last forever. If you'd like to help change someone's life and be a cheerful giver to the cause of God, go to our secure website, www.strongtowerradio.org, and click on the donate button or call 231-468-2087. Thanks for listening to, praying for, and supporting Strong Tower Radio, where God's character is changing lives one listener at a time.
Gary, the questions just keep coming in. I've got about 6 or 8 questions here. They're taking us serious here.
Okay, let's do it.
Okay. She bought some which flowers?
Cone flowers.
Okay, somebody bought some cone flowers, but they never came back up. I planted them on the east side of the house. What do I need to do to be able to grow them?
Just out of curiosity, what color were those cone flowers?
I bought one each color.
Well, the reason I asked the question is the traditional cone flower is kind of pinkish, and they seem to be tough, but I've tried growing some of the ones that are red and yellow and some of the other colors. They didn't seem to do as well during the winter. The thing that you need to do when something's not growing well is evaluate where you're putting it. Is the soil well-draining soil? Does it get full sunlight? Is it subject to drought or too much water, for instance? If I have something growing in the deck beds in the back of my house, water will sometimes come over the gutter and just wash out the whole area, and plants will have problems growing there. So you need to ask those questions. How long have you tried doing this?
I just did one season.
Just one season?
And I had multiples and none of them come up. I had like four or five.
And did you grow them from seed or did you buy plants?
I bought plants.
What time of the year did you plant them?
Probably July or August.
Yeah, that's a little late. I would try to put them in May, because putting something in July and August really stresses the plants. And so you have to really pay attention to make sure that they get the water that they need. Not as much nutrients, because you're getting to the time of the year when you want to start cutting back on nutrients. I wouldn't use anything more than a liquid fertilizer when I planted that late in the season. I wouldn't give up. I'd try again, but try putting them in May and see how it turns out.
Okay, another question. They had a phlox clump that just dried up and died last year. This year they have... The lower leaves are starting to turn yellow. Is there something that they can do and save this plant?
Well, I'd have to see it, but phlox can get powdery mildew. Have you noticed whether or not powdery mildew got on? Is that your question too? Did you see a whitish covering on the leaves?
I'll have to look. I don't know.
Yeah, because powdery mildew usually will start lower on the plant because that's the more shaded area, and that's where moisture will be, the humidity will be higher because of moisture in the ground. And diseases, like for instance tomato diseases, you notice they start at the bottom and they move their way up the plant. So check that. And if you have powdery mildew, what I would suggest you do is make sure that you put on a preventative fungicide if the conditions are right for it. And the conditions when you have 3 or 4 days worth of rainy weather is when you start getting infections of that type, especially when the temperatures reach around 60 degrees or higher. Other than that, making sure that there's plenty of room between plants so that when the wind is blowing, it dries off the leaves as quickly as possible would be helpful. Also, when you're watering the plants, try not to wet the leaves late in the day. So you don't want the leaves going into the night wet, because that also encourages diseases.
What type of fungicide do you?
There are many different fungicides. If you want to try to use an organic fungicide, I would probably try Serenade or a copper-based fungicide, like a copper sulfate. That's usually for bacteria, but it might work on powdery mildew. I'd have to do a little research on that one, because I don't have everything up here.
Okay.
And you know what else, too, you can use? My very friend, ChatGPT. Once you identify what the problem is, you could say, "Chat, I have powdery mildew on my phlox. Tell me what's labeled, and I'd like an organic fungicide." And I'm telling you, it's pretty good.
Amazing.
So that's so Gary can sleep at night, so we don't call you all night long.
No. If I would have had that available when I was working, I would have told him, "You don't need me anymore." Because a lot of the things that we used to do in the office and answering questions and stuff, ChatGPT can do it now.
Yeah, we're going to it more and more under your advice. Tomatoes, they have tomatoes that they tend to deplete soil. So they have a 8 by 4 foot bed. How do you replenish the soil?
Well, one thing you have to understand about tomatoes is they're very deep rooted. They can send roots down six feet, which means they'll take advantage of any nutrients all the way down that point. But there are booklets that you can get from MSU, or go to chat again, and you can ask if you want to know how many pounds of nutrients on a per acre basis or per thousand square feet or whatever you want, will it remove of phosphorus, potassium, nitrogen, or whatever. And that's why we fertilize annually, because plants remove it. And if you're not putting the residual back into the soil, which we usually don't, then you're constantly taking a withdrawal from your nutrient account. So how do we add it back? Well, obviously, fertilizers are one thing, either organic or chemical fertilizers. The plant doesn't know the difference, but there are some differences between the two. Also, you can add organic matter. Organic matter will do a couple of things. One, it will provide some nutrients, but it also provides the ability for the soil to hold on to nutrients, because organic matter, clay particles, silt particles are all negatively charged. And some of these nutrients, like potassium, for instance, and phosphorus, they're positively charged, so they're attracted to each other. So when you have higher levels of organic matter in your soil, what nutrients you put there will tend to stay there, except nitrogen. It tends to just go on through the soil profile. Also, working in manures, like, and when I say animal manures, we're basically talking about cow manure, sheep manure, horse manure, those types of things. You will bring in some weed seeds with horse manure, but it still has nutrients in it, and that can be helpful. In smaller areas, it's not really practical to put in cover crops, but cover crops can be grown someplace else, harvested, and composted in that small area. So those are all ways that you can build up the soil. One of the things I do at home, I'm retired now, so I do weird things. One of the things I do, we keep all of our potato peelings, and when I eat avocados, I keep all of those things, and then I let them air dry. And when they're nice and crispy, my wife bought me an old blender, and I blend it down, and it's a nice little brown powder. And I do the same thing with eggshells, and eggshells are like a lining material. And so those things can be worked into the garden too, and the worms will love it. Don't put too many eggshells, though, in a small area, because it'll tend to raise your pH. So kitchen materials that you normally would throw away can be composted. And I don't have any right now, but I even have worm composting bins. And when we're peeling things, they're going into the composting bins, and they turn into just a beautiful compost. And adding those things over time can make a big difference, too.
Hey, Susa, you have a question?
About replenishing nutrients. I was online and I saw that there was this special compost that you could buy. So they told you where they could buy it. Well, it turns out it was at one of our local garden centers. So I went there to buy it. But that's what I use. I planted a bunch of trees last year, and I mixed in that compost with, and it had no animal manure. It was, what did they call it? Vegetable landfill, something or other compost. But Gary, I don't think Gary even saw the bag, but
no, I did.
I'm a master gardener myself, so I went and bought the stuff and planted my trees and put them in the beds. And I think it's good if you don't want to keep fertilizing. He says like organic matter adds the ability for the plants to
hold on to those, pick up the nutrients that they don't go down through the soil so quickly.
Compost in the bag is. I used all of our compost. We had a big barrel of compost. I used it all. And I said, okay, I got to get more compost real quick. So then I went out and bought that stuff. So.
Also, in a lot of cities, they will have municipal composting when they get the leaves up. Mm-hmm. And they will leave it away free. So you just have to find out where it is. And they have you load it up yourself. And you can add this material. And there's some other additives. You might have heard of things like azomite. And there are a number of additives that will have micronutrients in them or certain minerals. You can get them from Amazon and places like that, and you can also supplement the soil with some of those. So always think about adding things back to your soil, not just always taking away.
There's here's a question. What are some good plants, perennials, and or ornamental grasses to plant over a well?
Over a well?
Yeah. Yes, the...
A well.
Well,
our well at home.
The water well.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well,
So the reason it doesn't grow in that area?
No, she wants to just disguise it.
Just want to put a flower bed around it.
Just want to be cosmetic.
Well, there are things that you can buy, like artificial rocks and things that you can cover that with. But one of the things I'd be careful about is putting ornamental grasses around it, because eventually you're going to have some work done on the well.
Yeah.
For instance, we just had the well casing replaced. And sometimes they'll have to pull the pump because the pumps go bad after a while. And if you have a lot of stuff growing around there, it's going to get stomped.
Yeah.
And the people that work on the well are not going to be happy to have to deal with all that. So you might not want to put ornamental grasses there because they can get big. And you can use like some of the smaller ones like miscanthus. There's some smaller miscanthus that you can put there. And then plant annual flowers, because if you lose some annual flowers, you just replant them next year. But I would go easy on the perennials.
I got an idea.
Mm-hmm.
I found at a garden center a what looked like a well, a wooden one with a wooden top. And I put that on top of my well, and then I put a planter in it. So it's covered.
Kind of like the old one you'd crank up and open well.
Yeah, it would look like that. Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
But it's a smaller version.
Yes, just ornamental,
And another thing I would do is get on Google and type in Google things that you can put over a well cover, and then go to images, and then it'll show you all kinds of crazy things.
I was confused about that, because one site will say, yes, you can put this here, and another site will say, no, you can't.
Yeah, you'll run into that sometime, but I would try not to put a lot of plants around there for the... Well, the well casing is not going to be threatened unless there's holes in it. So when they'll eventually rust. And I could see if you had holes, roots will get in there, and that could cause problems. But just from the maintenance standpoint, I'd be careful about what I put around it.
Do all annuals have shallow roots?
For the most part, yeah.
So the question is that don't most annuals have shallow roots? They don't.
Well, the reason I was suggesting annuals is because if somebody has to do a lot of work around the well and they trample your flowers, they're just annuals. But if I had perennials that I really liked and somebody's stomping them, I'm not going to be too happy. And so then you'd have to, they say, well, we're going to come over and you got to move all those plants. Then you're going to dig up all these plants. And it's just a real hassle. So I'd go another route.
So here's a question. How do you stop a mint from growing over the other plants in the garden? How do you control it?
The only way that you can try to limit something that you want in the bed, but it's a little invasive, is to put it in a container. And for the most part, you can keep it somewhat contained, but that's not always a guarantee either. So you'd put a pot and sink the pot in, and then you'd have to have batches of whatever it is in various places.
Because mint goes by the roots, not by seed, right?
I think so, yeah.
Statement is it grows a bit.
Well, it'll reseed, but I don't know the exact method of spreading.
Roots.
Yeah, it's probably roots, because I don't remember seeing stolons or anything like that. Did you have a comment, or? Okay.
Here's a question. If Roundup is so bad, why is it still used?
Well.
Because it works.
The thing is, there are certain pesticide laws that if they're found to cause birth defects or cancer, there is a process to take something off the market.
But something that, like Roundup, that's been on the market for a long period of time, it's a fight because Monsanto has a lot of money and they have a nice little gig going with Roundup. The thing about Roundup and most weed killers is they tend to be fairly low on toxicity. In other words, if you were spraying yourself with an insecticide, you're going to get sick pretty quickly. But with herbicides, they're a little different, and you don't get a toxic response right away. You might get a long-term response. For instance, there's a lawsuit against Monsanto about Roundup possibly causing leukemia. And most people, when they're using Roundup, they don't use the minimal personal protective equipment. So, is that a phone? But anyway, it doesn't bother me. But if you use the minimal personal protection and try to limit your exposure and follow the directions, you're probably okay, but there's no guarantees. And there's no guarantees with any chemical that's on the market. That's the world we live in. And one of the things I used to teach people in the Master Gardener program is when they test chemicals for toxicity, they're testing that single chemical alone. But there are many things where we use combinations of chemicals together. They have no idea what it does. No idea whatsoever.
So this will be our last question. How do you get rid of Creeping Charlie?
Yeah, Creeping Charlie is a wonderful little problem, but there is a product that will kill it. You do have to use a chemical for this one. I call it Weed Be Gone Purple. It has a purple label on it, like a little purple fringe. It's called Weed Be Gone Oxalis Clover and Something Killer. And it works best when you spray it around October, early October, on a nice sunny day. And what's happening at that point is a lot of the perennials are taking the carbohydrates that they're making and they're shipping them down to the roots. So there's a lot of translocation at that time. When you spray this Weed Be Gone Purple on it, it goes right down to the roots and it will kill the Creeping Charlie. It'll wipe it right out. Now, it doesn't look like it's going to do anything. You spray it in the fall and you come back 2-3 weeks later, it looks just fine. Next spring, you come back, it's gone. So it works really well. If you don't want to use a chemical, then the only way you'll be able to get rid of it is to smother it. And the way to do that would be to get at least 4 mil thick black plastic and cover the whole area over. And that will kill it. Now, it can come back because Creeping Charlie that's been somewhere for a while will drop seeds. And those seeds can come back and germinate. But if you have the area mulched, then you won't get the problem as quickly.
Very good. Gary, this has been absolutely wonderful. This is the second time we've done it, and it's been a wonderful response and great questions.
Well, I had fun.
All right. So for Good Growing with the Garden Guy, this is July edition of it. We'll be back next month with August. And thank you, audience. Will you just say something? Goodbye.
Bye.
Thank you very much, audience, and thank you for being a part of Strong Tower Radio. For Gary Heilig and Tom Majeur and the Strong Tower Radio Network, God be with you.
Amen.
Bye now.